From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Robert Siegel. This summertime novelty tune has been pouring out of radios now for 50 years.
Hello, mother. Hello, father. Here I am at Camp Granada. Camp is very entertaining. And they say we'll have some fun if it stops raining.
In late July of 1963, Billboard magazine reported that fans were, and I quote, actually breaking down doors, unquote, of record stores to buy the song about the pains of summer camp. The man behind this sensation was a short, plump guy with a crew cut, big glasses, and a surprisingly small nose. He'd had it fixed. Alan Sherman had been a TV producer who'd entertained his friends with song parodies for years. He then collected them on an LP called My Son, the Folk Singer. Old favorites were rewritten with a contemporary suburban Jewish audience in mind. It was never expected to appeal to the general public.
I'm upside down, my head is turning around because I gotta sell the house in Levittown. Oh, salesmen come and salesmen go, and my best one is gone, I know. And if he don't come back to me, I'll have to close the factory. But give me Jack Cone, and I don't care.
Oh, to everyone's surprise, by August of 1963, three Sherman albums were on Billboard's Top 100 chart. Mark Cohen has written a book about the short-lived success of the musical satirist. It's called, somewhat cruelly, Overweight Sensation, The Life and Comedy of Alan Sherman. And Mark Cohen joins us from New York. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Alan Sherman was funny, and at the time he was a very big success, but an almost scholarly book about him? I mean, what can we learn from this man's story?
Well, I think Sherman was a very interesting pop culture figure at a moment when ethnic identity was first blossoming in America in the post-war period. We had had a long period of Americanization. And Sherman appeared just at the moment when that was beginning to end.
And it's a real moment, certainly in the life of the American Jewish community, not just pop culture. Leonard Bernstein, the novelist Saul Bellow, and Philip Roth. It was a more frank depiction of what it was to be Jewish in America, and often a funny depiction.
Right, and that was one of Sherman's big themes, was trying to own some of the Jewish cultural products that Jews offered to America without, as I jokingly say, asking for a receipt.
I remember the Alan Sherman days, and this is part of my favorite Alan Sherman song called Shake Hands with Your Uncle Max.
Shake hands with your Uncle Max, my boy, and here is your sister Cheryl, and here is your cousin Isabel, that's Irving's oldest girl. And you remember the Tishman twins, Gerald and Jerome. We all came out to greet you and to wish you welcome home. Meet Merowitz, Barowitz, Handelman, Shandelman, Sperber and Gerber and Steiner and Stone, Moskowitz, Lupowitz, Aarons and Barons, Kleiman and Feynman and Friedman and Cohn, Smolowitz, Wallowitz.
You know, the problem for people who are not of a certain age is they don't know the Irish tune that this was satirizing.
That's true, but I also remember hearing this song before I understood that it was a parody of an earlier Irish tune. That didn't diminish my enjoyment of the song, but once I did learn it, it became even more brilliant.
The story of Alan Sherman, apart from his great success, he'd already been successful as a television producer. When he became a huge success, this is the classic, did success ruin Alan Sherman? The answer is absolutely, totally, fatally. He had a heart attack at a fairly early age.
He died before he turned 49. But, of course, the year of extraordinary fame that he enjoyed when his three My Son albums all went gold, made his life a success for him at any rate before things went fatally wrong.
So what went wrong?
Well, where do I begin? Sherman was an extraordinarily hungry man for all sorts of experiences, and that included drink, lots of food, lots of women, lots of gambling. I'm forgetting all the vices because he covered them all.
Here's the great irony, or perhaps it's more predictable than that, about Alan Sherman, which is he ends up becoming this guy who makes jokes about being Jewish in America in the 1960s. in his own family, his parents were terrible to him, ran from their Jewishness. He was ultimately raised by his much more happily Jewish grandparents.
He was born as Alan Coplin, and his mother, her maiden name was Rose Sherman. His father was Percy Coplin. His mother raised in Chicago. His father raised in Birmingham, Alabama. They were very unstable people who were really not capable of raising a child. And so his mother had to send him to her parents. And in his grandparents' home, he discovered the world that his mother left behind. And he decided, this is what I want in life.
In my very small sample of people under 40 that I've checked, Alan Sherman's humor is not all that accessible. And you have to transport yourself back to 1963. For example, this parody, which has, I think, one of his funniest lines ever written.
I'm singing you the ballad of a great man of the cloth. His name was Harry Lewis, and he worked for Irving Roth.
You have to assume that Jews in New York are deeply involved in employment in the garment industry. Cutting, sewing, selling, that this is what employed the better part of a huge Jewish community.
Oh, Harry Lewis perished in the service of his Lord. He was trampling through the warehouse where the drapes of Roth are stored.
He worked awfully hard for that joke.
That was a pretty darn good pun.
There are people from those days, like Mel Brooks, who went on, who survived, who became bigger than they were in the early 1960s. Alan Sherman, I don't know that, you know, that people remember him or know that much about him these days.
No, that's very true. Sherman was much more greatly damaged. I often think about that wonderful little poem I discovered that he wrote when he was in junior high school. Humpty Dumpty sat on a train, happily singing, Bemir Bistushane. He was a damaged, fragile Humpty Dumpty who could be made happy by singing Jewish-oriented songs.
Harvey and Sheila Harvey and Sheila Harvey and Sheila moved to West L.A.
He said the Christian name of this song is Hava Nagila. He felt Harvey and Sheila was really closer to the truth about American Jewish life than Hava Nagila itself.
Mark Cohn, author of Overweight Sensation, The Life and Comedy of Alan Sherman, thank you very much for talking with us about him today.
Robert, thank you very much for having me.
Oh, that Harvey, he was really smart. He used his noodle. Sheila bought a white French poodle. Went to Europe with a visa. Harvey's rich. They say that he's a VIP. This could be only in the USA.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. Today, in Your Health, we launch a series on one of the world's biggest public health problems, tuberculosis.
A third of the world's population is infected with the TB germ. Most of them won't ever get sick from it, but if something lowers their immunity, the disease can wreak havoc with lungs and other organs. Every year, 1.4 million people die from TB.
The United States has the world's best TB care and prevention programs, and it pays off. Officials say cases in this country are at an all-time low.
Still, TB is a stubborn adversary. NPR's Richard Knox reports on how the disease spread through one family and gave Boston public health officials some nasty surprises.
What? Since her mother died more than 2 years ago, Michelle Williams has been the one who holds things together. It's not easy. The Williams household contains three generations, and many other people often drop in.
Only difference between me and my mother was the kindest, the sweetest. I'm not.
On a typical weekend, a couple dozen people might congregate in this house. That's an important element of our story. Michelle's mother, Judy Williams, who died at the age of 59, is still a presence in the household. In a corner of the living room, her son Robert has constructed a memorial.
This is my shrine that I had put up for my mother right here. That's my mom. That's little flowers. I kept these since she died. And that's why I keep my memories right here.
Well, she's still in the middle of things.
Yeah, she's always going to be here.
For the last 30 years of her life, Judy Williams almost never left the family home. Robert says she was afraid to go out in the street because of all of the violence. Michelle thinks she had a mental disorder, a fear of the outside world that doctors call agoraphobia. But she loved to have people come to her house.
She used to always, you know, cook for a lot of people, invite people into the house. Like, if you're homeless, she let them stay there with the family and all.
And that may be how she got tuberculosis. She may have been infected for years. As much as she took care of others, Judy Williams never took care of herself. She smoked, and she weighed close to 400 pounds.
That's her right there.
When was that taken?
Ooh, that was taken. See how big she was? Oh, Lord, that was taken years ago. Years ago, before she even knew she was sick.
Toward the end of 2010, Judy Williams lost her appetite and began to lose weight. Finally, Michelle forced her to go to the doctor. Michael Malone, a public health nurse in Boston, picks up the story.
She weighed 260 pounds, and she had lost 100 to 150 pounds in the preceding several months.
That kind of weight loss can be a sign of tuberculosis. Doctors suspected it and wanted to do more tests. But Judy had a terrible fear of doctors and hospitals, and she didn't keep the follow-up appointments.
A visiting nurse had actually called into the hospital saying, you know, if this is TB, because the nurses knew that was one of the possibilities, there's a lot of people in and out of this household. There's several generations of family and a lot of visitors. And so if this turns out to be TB, there's going to be a large list of people exposed to Judy.
But Judy's TB didn't get diagnosed for another month or so after she was rushed to the hospital by ambulance in a diabetic crisis. And then there was a slip-up. Once she was past the crisis, Judy Williams was sent home. She should have been quarantined at a TB center until she was no longer contagious, but she was discharged over a holiday weekend in 2011, and public health officials didn't get notified in time. They could have required her to stay in the hospital for treatment.
My sense is it was her strong desire to go home and not remain in the hospital that may have been a force that had her home in a matter of 5 or 6 days.
A month later, Judy Williams began coughing up blood at home.
I see my mother. I hate talking about it. When I went to the hospital, that's how she was, just laid up like that on life support. So I just pulled the plug on the 15th of February.
Robert was so distraught he couldn't bring himself to go to her funeral. As soon as Judy Williams was diagnosed with TB, public health workers began doing tests to see if she'd infected others.
Around 20 people in the extended family were tested, and about half of those showed evidence of TB infection.
All were in an early stage of infection. They had no symptoms and couldn't pass TB to anyone else. All but one completed a 9-month course of medicine to prevent the infection from progressing. At this point, the public health people thought they'd done their job, so they were shocked last October, 20 months after Judy Williams' death, when her 35-year-old nephew came to the hospital with advanced TB.
It's a very painful discovery. He'd had 2 skin tests, which pointed away from any infection. He was never offered prevention medicine because there was no indication for it. And yet he obviously had been infected.
Then, a month later, a 20-year-old man came to the hospital with active TB, the boyfriend of one of Judy Williams' granddaughters. Meanwhile, Judy's son Robert had been losing a lot of weight. Around Thanksgiving of last year, he felt like he couldn't breathe. Turns out TB had eaten a large hole in his lung. Robert was sent to a state hospital for 2 months of quarantine until he was no longer contagious. DNA testing showed all 3 men were infected with the same strain of TB as Judy Williams, meaning they got it from her. But all 3 men had tested negative for TB on 2 successive skin tests done back in 2011.
We thought it had to be a fluke, really an outlier, that someone would have negative skin tests and be infected with TB. But that is one of the limitations of the test. Some people just don't respond to these type of tests.
And sometimes the results can be wrong when health workers don't wait long enough between the 1st and 2nd skin tests. Malone says it's all been a sobering reminder of how challenging it can be to track TB infection and prevent its spread.
Hindsight was an unfortunately good teacher in telling us that we may have done our 2nd round of testing too quickly in this case when Judy was ill. And also when she returned home, she may have remained contagious right up to the time of her sudden death in a way that we hadn't fully appreciated back at that time.
Another more aggressive round of testing in the Williams family and their close contacts revealed three more infections, all in people who had tested negative in early 2011. They include Michelle, her first husband, and her four-year-old granddaughter. So now, more than 2 years after TB was first diagnosed in the Williams family, they're still struggling with the disease.
Harrison Avenue, Boston Medical Center.
This your stop?
Yes, it is.
Every day, Robert takes the bus to a TB clinic where a nurse watches him take a handful of pills.
Okay, that looks about right?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, it's about 10 pills here.
The main point is just to give him his medications and that we watch him take his medications, okay. That's all.
Have to be really sure.
Yes, we have to be sure. Make sure that he's getting the medicine he's supposed to so that he can get better each day.
If he starts missing doses, Robert could develop a resistant form of TB that's more dangerous and difficult to treat. Michelle makes sure that she and her granddaughter, Anaya, don't miss a dose of medicine or a monthly checkup.
I need to get Anaya's weight first.
Okay.
Can you take off your jacket? We need to get your weight.
Nurse Pamela Coppinger says Anaya has gained a little weight, so her medication dose may need to be increased. She asks Michelle if she takes her medicine without fail.
I take mine every day.
Okay.
I see what happened to my mother. I don't play with it. You know, since my mother passed, it's just too scary for me. You know what I mean? This is weird because I don't know where this stuff's coming from.
Well, the good news is it's treatable. And that's what you're here for now, to prevent the TB germ from waking up and making you sick and Anaya sick.
Within a few months, everybody in the Williams family will finish treatment and can finally put TB behind them. Richard Knox, NPR News, Boston.
Later today on All Things Considered, how the Eastern European country of Moldova is struggling with the spread of drug-resistant TB.
A new airline with an innovative business model is about to take off. Federal regulators have just given California-based Surf Air permission to begin passenger service. As NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports, it's an all-you-can-fly airline with payment made by regular subscription.
Surf Air is a big idea with small planes. For a flat monthly fee, subscribers will be able to take all the trips they want between four California cities. The airline's co-founder and CEO, Wade Ierly, boasts that Surf Air will offer frequent commuters a corporate jet experience for not that much more than regular airline prices.
So we're walking in, you've parked your car, pull the door open, and you see a sign where the concierge is standing to greet you. Let them know you're here for Surf Air.
We caught up with Ierly at the General Aviation Facility on the far side of the Burbank Airport in metropolitan Los Angeles. Instead of using big, busy terminals, Surf Air will fly out of smaller, low-key places like this one. No TSA screening is required, so there's no conga line, no emptying your pockets, or removing your shoes.
You're about probably 50 feet from the plane as it pulls up, and then the concierge will come get you when it's time to go.
Only one person at a time on the stairs, please.
The total amount of time, from parking your car to ducking inside the plane, could be less than 5 minutes. The Swiss-made 8-passenger turboprop has a single engine and two pilots. The longest flight between San Francisco and Los Angeles would be just over an hour. The airline originally suggested the monthly subscription price would be about $1,000, but late last week, Surf Air said the first group of subscribers would pay a lot more, $1,650 a month for an unlimited number of flights.
We're all you can fly the way old Netflix worked.
Wade Ierly recalls that with Netflix, you used to be able to order all the DVDs you wanted, but could hold only a few of them at a time. With Surf Air, you can have just four boarding passes at once.
It keeps any one member from sort of boxing everybody else out from every flight and makes sure that there's enough sort of capacity for everyone to be able to book regularly.
Analyst Wayne Plucker, who's with the firm Frost & Sullivan, has been following the airline's progress.
If they can get enough subscribers and keep them happy for long enough, it's a reasonable business model.
But he cautions that the economics of any airline are tricky and says Surf Air will need enough cushion to cover mechanical or other problems. When Surf Air first emerged as a concept, it drew thousands of people to its list of potential subscribers. But with the substantial increase in price, it's hard to know how many will actually sign up. Evan Owens, the founder of a startup called Pogo Seat, isn't joining right now, but remains intrigued by the potential for making new business contacts in flight.
It's really the network connections, I think. You know, if I sit down and meet an awesome startup founder or investor who ends up, you know, investing in Pogo Seat, that makes Surf Air completely worth it.
Another entrepreneur, Francis Pedraza, of a startup called Everest, also notes the potential for networking, but adds the promise of faster door-to-door travel that's hassle-free is also appealing.
If I know that they understand me and they get me and they care about every little detail of the user experience, I'm far more likely to go with them than some airline that I just don't think gets it or cares about me or has any clue what customer service means.
Surf Air CEO Wade Ierley says he knows if passengers aren't happy, they won't renew their subscriptions and the airline will fail. But Ierley, who's new to the airline industry, doesn't seem worried.
This is a market desperate for disruption. Airlines are literally the only industry that ranked below cable companies for what people think of them. Dead last out of 47 industries surveyed, no one likes flying.
Ierley hopes that will change when Surf Air takes to the skies. The first flight is expected in a couple of weeks. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
Many victims of sexual assault in the military say only one experience comes close to the pain of the actual crime, and that is going to court and bringing charges against the attacker. This may be one reason why so few victims do come forward and report these crimes. Now the Air Force is hoping a new team of lawyers will help change that. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
At Maxwell Air Force Base in Alabama, a tall, three-star general stands in front of a class of JAG officers, Air Force lawyers. He tells them they are pioneers in a new field, and then he lays a heavy responsibility on them.
I don't want to put too much pressure on you, but I will tell you that the eyes of the nation are on you.
Lieutenant General Richard Harding has high hopes for the officers who have come to this base for training in a new field. They are among the first Special Victims Councils, or SVCs. They're attorneys who do not represent the defendant. They don't represent the government. They will stand up for the victims. Harding tells the audience they can help address the agony many assault victims associate with the court-martial process.
We know 85% of our victims don't report today. Maybe if they understood the value of an SVC, some of them might feel a little bit more comfortable about reporting.
That's the long-term hope for the Special Victims Council program, which is currently limited to the Air Force but could expand to other services. The immediate goal is to train around 60 lawyers who will help victims get through the legal process. And that's what the Special Victim Councils have already been trying to do in the 300 or so cases they've handled in the program's first few months. Captain Lorraine Salt says her work as a counsel near Colorado Springs has underscored that prosecutors don't speak for the victim.
And a prosecutor's goal really is the conviction. And my experience with my clients is that that's not always what the victim's goal is.
Sometimes watching out for a client's interests means making sure that private information isn't disclosed unnecessarily. And sometimes it means arguing for a different kind of justice.
I had a client, she didn't want to go through the court-martial process, but she wanted the individual who assaulted her to get help. And so we just worked through that together with the prosecutor. It ended up working out for her because she didn't have to go to court, but the person did leave the Air Force.
Special Victims Councils can also help airmen get transferred, deal with housing issues, or make sure that they feel safe in the aftermath of the assault. Some victims also have to deal with the fact that reporting an assault can result in charges against them for underage drinking, for example. Special Victims Councils can help with that. For the young lawyers who have been handpicked for this job, it can be a tough assignment. Aaron Kirk, a 31-year-old captain working in San Antonio, has heard some horrible stories.
From unprofessional relationship in a sort of basic military trainee context to very serious traumatic assaults.
No matter how serious the charges, Special Victims Councils stay with the victim, making sure, for example, that prosecutors don't offer an easy plea bargain. Kirk says the job can also include helping victims deal with disappointment.
One of my clients has had an acquittal, and it's devastating.
Victims' councils have existed for years in the civilian world, but the idea is a new one for the military, and it's raised some touchy legal questions. Some Air Force judges have refused to give these attorneys standing in court. The Air Force JAG office is currently fighting for that right. And some defense attorneys say the presence of a third party in court could help stack the deck against a defendant. Victor Hansen, a retired Army JAG officer now teaching at New England Law Boston, says providing the victim with an attorney could create a kind of bias.
And that could be perceived, I think, even by a military panel, that there's already been a determination that the victim is credible before the case even goes to trial.
That dispute could be important to the future of this program, although the Air Force says special victims counsels can still do a lot outside the courtroom. Initial surveys show that victims have been pretty happy with this new service, but it will be much harder to prove that this program will convince more victims to report crimes, and it may be harder still to show that it can help reduce the number of assaults. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
Over the weekend, surfers gathered on a Santa Monica beach in Southern California to honor Nick Gabaldon. He's a legend in the sport and the area's first documented surfer of African American and Mexican heritage. NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates visited the celebration. She's with NPR's team Code Switch, which reports on race, ethnicity, and culture.
The morning fog was burning off above the part of Santa Monica's beach that's known as the Inkwell. It's the stretch of sand to which black Southern Californians were relegated by de facto segregation until the 1960s. Men, women, and children were walking across the sand in wetsuits carrying surfboards. They're part of the Black Surfers Collective, which aims to get more people of color involved in surfing. After a jazzy rendition of the national anthem, libations were poured onto the flower-strewn sand for the ancestors, the sea, and especially for Nick Gabaldon, who was honored as a master waterman and barrier breaker. After the prayer, priestess Nana Jumfi says she knows a lot of people who would be surprised to see this crowd of black and brown surfers, but the tradition isn't new in other countries.
When you say surfing, people do not think of black people. But I have images of little black boys in Ghana with some driftwood, standing up, you know, before there was television.
Jeff Williams, one of the organizers of Nick Gabaldon Day, wants people to remember how physically heroic Gabaldon was.
And that was the story of a guy who in the 40s and 50s used to leave this historic beach of the Inkwell in Santa Monica and paddle the 12 miles north up to Malibu to surf Surfrider Beach, which is a world-renowned surf break.
It was in Malibu that Gabaldon died in 1951 after a surfing accident. But his legacy is still very much felt here. Delilah Villot, dripping wet after riding several waves, says children of color need to know surfing is open to them.
That's why I think this is so important, because I didn't even know to ask.
Seeing people of color on boards may make others think to try it. 11-year-old Gregory Rochelle surfs and wants to help other kids do it too.
If we have the chance to help them surf, I bet surfing will get bigger around the community.
Of course, access to the beach remains a barrier to many communities. Meredith McCarthy of Heal the Bay, one of the organizations that co-sponsored Nick Gabaldon Day, says she sees how serious the issue of access is when she visits inner-city schools. It's a long bus ride from many neighborhoods, and even if you can drive, parking is expensive.
When I say, how many kids have been to the beach, and four or five of them raise their hand, I know that I have a lot of work to do.
Today, the work is getting visitors conversant with the language of surfing.
And what is this called? The bottom of the board or the belly?
And while their boards are on the sand, teaching them how to paddle out, crouch, and stand. After the lessons, it's time to hit the water.
Everyone should be on your board!
There's a lot of splashing and squealing, and not just among the juvenile surfers.
Is he still on the board? Look at her! Ah,
that's Leslie Rose reveling in daughter Izzy's smooth ride to the shore. Other parents are watching in delighted amazement as their children surf in, a little wobbly, on today's gentle waves. The Black Surfers Collective's Jeff Williams shakes off the drops and tries to explain what the newbies are feeling.
To be able to catch a wave and completely live in the moment of that time of reality, there's nothing like it.
Or, as Leslie Rose would put it,
this is awesome!
Totally. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Audie Cornish, and now we're going to introduce you to a pair of rising stars in the world of jazz. They riff like a pair of old friends, but they only met a couple of years ago.
Our first meeting was in the 21st century through Skype.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
So we didn't actually formally meet until several months later.
So my imagination that you met in a smoky jazz club somewhere, I'm making it a little too romantic. It was Skype.
It was Skype.
I didn't know what time it was then I met you. Oh, what a lovely time it was.
Cecile McLaurin-Salvant and Aaron Deal have both racked up major industry awards, but they traveled radically different paths to get there. Deal, a pianist, was performing church hymns at Mass from age 8. He went on to Juilliard. McLaurin-Salvant studied Baroque music in France before a professor there convinced her to try singing jazz.
To be alive, to be young, to be mad, to be yours alone.
Aaron Deal plays piano on the new album by Cecile McLaurin-Salvant. It's called Woman Child. At the ripe old age of 23, she plucks tunes from the early days of jazz, a long way away from her own teenage tastes.
I was in a group of friends. We used to listen to a lot of grunge, so that was a little odd, too, because it was kind of 10 years old already. We would go to Soundgarden concerts and things like that.
Funny enough, I didn't really listen to a lot of jazz until my teenage years. I loved classical music from when I started playing, which was about 6 or 7 years old. So I was sort of kind of that weird, nerdy kid who loved to listen to Bach and Brahms and, you know, Vivaldi. Yeah, no grunge music for me.
Wow. So do you think about that now as you are producing music yourself? Are you conscious at all of trying to do music that those kids might want to listen to, you know, to draw people in?
It's funny, I was talking to Aaron about this the other day. I actually try to routinely go back to my 15-year-old self, and I try to make music that will also draw that type of person in, all the while still being very authentic and trying to be excellent at it.
Yeah, I like how Cecile used the word authentic, because for me, I want to create an insatiable appetite for jazz, and where the music can be accessible to a wider audience, but the music should always have a high level of quality and authenticity. I really like that word, authentic.
When life seems full of clouds and rain, and I am filled with naught but pain, who soothes my bumping brain? Nobody. When winter comes with snow and sleet, and me with hunger and cold feet, who says, here's 25 cents, go on, get something to eat? Nobody.
It seems like on this album you're not afraid to kind of go back and reach for works that people may look at now as controversial. In particular, a song like You Bring Out the Savage in Me.
My blood boils with the tropic heat, and the rhythm of my heart has a tom-tom beat.
Well, I heard that song because I was listening to Valida Snow, who was this great singer, band leader, trumpet player. She was an amazing woman who was most successful in the 1930s. And she sang a bunch of novelty songs. She sang songs like I Can't Dance, I've Got Ants in My Pants, and You Bring Out the Savage in Me, which when I first heard it, I couldn't help but laugh, because I thought, goodness, how racist to be, you know, to be a black woman singing, you know, You Bring Out the Savage in Me, You Can Be My Ape Man.
Just like Tarzan, be my ape man. I'm getting so ferocious and I can't escape, man.
And I just immediately wanted to sing it because it was so completely absurd and outrageous, and I wanted to be able to laugh about it too, you know.
My blood boils with the tropic heat, and the rhythm of my heart has a tom-tom beat. You bring out the savage in me. Primitive love cries move my ears with the pressure of 100 million years.
Playing a song like You Bring Out the Savage in Me, you guys are both kind of reaching back into a sensitive time for Black America. And you're both young, you're both Black. What is it like for you to try and reclaim these works?
Well, I feel that it's important to capture as much of the language of jazz as possible in order to create my own unique identity. And so even more so than the social connotations associated with certain pieces or certain periods, I think about the music as a language and how I can study and use the evolution of the language to my benefit and then distill that in an emotional way that reaches the listener.
For either of you, does it put you in the heads of these artists who are doing the same work you're doing, but just under such different circumstances?
You know, when you read about some of these musicians' lives and the context in which they were playing and learning and studying the music, it's pretty amazing and it's pretty sobering, you know, and humbling. You know, just reading about someone like Bessie Smith or, I don't know, Charlie Parker.
Bud Powell.
Yeah. Just hearing the amount of stress and difficulty in which they were playing inspires me to work even more.
And what they sacrificed in their lives. I mean, I feel like it makes the responsibility even greater for me to be a steward of the tradition of jazz.
Exactly.
Just like a beggar, what can I do? Hungry for kisses and starving for you. Press your lips to my lips. Oh, have pity on me.
Pianist Aaron Deal and singer Cecile McLaurin-Salvant. Deal's latest album is called The Bespoke Man's Narrative, and this song, Baby Have Pity on Me, can be found on the debut album by Cecile McLaurin-Salvant. It's called Woman Child.
Where they belong. Press me, caress me. Oh, have pity on me.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.